mentioned in the commissioner leadership. They've been taking notes. They had these two DARs in their pocket, and they read up on it and came with questions. They endured, which I have to say, I predictably guessed, maybe not. I'm an hour off.
No,
how long it
oh,
might take.
An hour? Okay. Well, we had some technical difficulties.
Yes. Thank you, Mark. So for commissioners that haven't done this before, we've had the city of Gresham here before. We've had the city of Seattle here before. We've had the city of Edmonton, Canada here before. We've also even had a town in Japan here before. And there's some others that are all aficionados of the process. So I think right now I really wanted to keep this kind of a casual debrief. We've had a lot of discussion via email and phone calls up to this moment. And like I mentioned over lunch, we've talked through our process, what we do, particularly with a focus on DARs and why and how they work and what they do for the design review process. We've also talked a little bit about the difference between discretionary design review, which is what we do in this room, and the objective standards track design review, which gets all different grades of products out there in design overlay land. So maybe we could just start quickly by introducing ourselves. And then I think I just wanted to leave it open for the city of Eugene to kind of ask some questions about what they heard or what you may still have questions about and how else we can kind of get you off and feel good about what you were here doing today. So, Robin, why don't we start your end?
Sure. My name is Robin Hossick, senior urban design planner with the city of Eugene. I'm a landscape architect, actually, by training, most of my career. I've been pulled into the world of urban design. Our focus has been to create some kind of a design, well, it's not a focus, one of many things we have to do right now, up in the ante with design expectations in our communities. We plan over 20 years. Growth and change and holding UGB for both commercial and multifamily use for the next 20 years is going to require us to do something that we want to invest in the community. And if we make those investments, we also need to make sure that the product is good. So design review seems like an important part of that. The community is asking for it. And the question is how, when scale is obviously very different from what is happening up here, the economics are very different. We have a lot of questions around both your experiences and just what advice you would have for us since we're starting more or less fresh with this kind of work. So, and we really appreciate being out here. You all had a long afternoon of conversation, so thanks for staying with us for a little bit more.
Don't worry, but this is usually about halftime for us.
Oh my gosh.
I'm Steve Niestrom, and I'm the principal planner in the city of Eugene. I oversee the current planning section of the city, so I'm really interested to watch kind of the dynamics here and how it kind of plays out on the ground. As Robin said, we're just kind of in the exploratory mode right now to really understand a little bit more how it works here, and for me, trying to translate and how things operate through and how that can be applicable to the rest of Eugene. Obviously, there are a lot of different dynamics in terms of the scale of development. The economics and just even the pace of development that you see versus what we see. So I'm trying to translate that.
I'm Nan Lawrence. My background is in architecture and in planning, and I work specifically using urban renewal dollars to increase the density and the quality of development in downtown. I was so interested in the conversation about height with the first project because we've just approved, actually it's under construction now, 120-foot building, which is very tall for Eugene. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to have you all have that conversation and to go back to criteria and fall back on policy was really interesting. I really appreciated that. That was great.
Melissa Hansen, senior planner. I work both on current planning as well as on long range, and somewhere in the middle most of the time. So it's fascinating taking the vision and writing that into code or design standards. Hmm.
Stephen Baker, I'm a member of the Planning Commission, but I have a background in architecture and engineering.
worked for the state for many years on large buildings, so.
I'm Bill Randall. Excuse me, I'm an architect, a senior principal of Arbor South Architecture in Eugene. I also currently serve as the chair of the planning commission. And it was fascinating hearing your discussion as far as heights and mass and that on the first project. And I guess I wonder why you couldn't do commercial along the front street side of the platform.
It's called small victories, you know.
I'm Jennifer Dow, and I work with Robin on his urban design team. And my background also is in architecture, and I'm learning how to apply that in the realm of planning.
Thanks, you guys. How do you want to
the move forward? Ones that haven't.
Sorry, Jeff.
Yeah, right.
We all know who you are.
Yeah. Jeff Simpson. My background's landscape architecture as well. I have a small firm here in Portland, and we do landscape architecture, urban design, and planning. So that's my background.
We had lunch together, so they.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so we know us.
Okay.
So, Ben?
My name's Ben Kaiser. I'm an architect and a general contractor here in Portland. So we do development, design, and build.
I'm Dave Keltner. I'm a design principal at a local firm, THA Architecture, and have been on commission. I've been working on commission for 4 years.
Yeah.
Is it four?
Hopefully more.
Oh, how long? But you've been on how long so far? Two.
It's four.
Really? It's been three?
Oh.
Oh, almost four. Oh, wow. It does fly. Yeah.
So how did you get three architects and a landscape architect
done? I'll answer that.
Yeah.
Well, David Work is Phil's position required for the Regional Arts and Culture Council.
Okay.
So while he's trained as an architect, he's Phil's.
I happen to be an architect. I have a lot of background in coordinating with artists, and so I've been in that realm often. And so I was tapped by the previous commissioner that held that, and he was also an architect through RAC. So they like that combination quite a bit, because even here we try to kind of wed together art and architecture. There they like to understand what the impacts are to art and what art is doing to architecture. There's a part in the code that says you can get additional FAR, is it, through art,
among other things.
Right. Right, very rarely used. It was used on that project,
the
same developer, right, for the four blocks. That's quite a deal he got.
Yeah.
You get a 1-to-1 FAR for, what's the percent of?
It was 1% for art, 1% of the total project.
Right. Yeah.
It's big art installation going on.
Yeah, two of them, yeah. Yeah, anyway, sorry.
Well, he's a part of the approval.
Right. Right.
And we also, who you're not seeing here today, are Jane Hansen, and she's a landscape architect. And Tad Savnar, who's man about town.
urban planner. Urban planner and artist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No one knows what that is.
Deal breaker, you know.
So you do try and get people in at least
diverse.
Yeah, in fact, this one that we're missing, we used to have the civil engineer, which was really good.
We're just creative with dual.
I saw something looking through this. Actually, you pointed it out that the person from Sarah Architects comes a lot.
Yeah.
Is that?
Okay.
Right.
Areas of the city that are type three design. And they also, part of it is their firm specializes in. They do a lot of apartment, multifamily. Unit, design, and that's largely what we've seen lately. That's the big And that accounts for a lot of the development.
That's the market right now, right?
Did they also do that project just
no.
south of the
No. Really? That was another architecture firm.
So that
but, yeah, right.
The architecture with that pretty well.
So with which one?
With the Pavilion?
Oh, with the River Stage?
Oh, no, they didn't do that. No, 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 no.
Pacifica.
Yeah, who did Pacifica?
No, I think LRS.
I thought LRS, yeah, LRS did, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Right.
So I have a question. It's kind of a question that's probably on all of our minds as we think about it and actually creating potentially more process. It seems like this is an iterative process mm-hmm. most of the time, right? So. Mm-hmm. Come in, talk about design, they come back again, you talk more, eventually they do an application, and hopefully by then they're good, but even that might take a couple of tries, yes. right? So,
you hope it's an iterative process. Sometimes they come in, and they come in, and they come in, and you keep saying the same thing over and over again, and they look like they're writing it down.
Do they page the theme?
I don't know.
The flat theme on the front.
And you can come back.
I mean, with the ARS, typically limited it to two. You know, with type three, so it's as many as it takes, but we have 120-day clock ticking. At the end of the day, it's a lot of, you know, consulting fees in the room per hour.
Yeah,
so
right.
Usually
right.
It's self-regulating, but I'm surprised.
People don't like coming back, and it's not.
No,
like
no.
How many rooms are max?
Six,
hour.
I think, well.
Well,
what?
Was it?
Are we talking hours or are we talking number of returns?
This one.
Aggregate?
It was well, that one and it's the four building properties that we looked at.
The one over in Selwood.
But actually, the Lloyd Center one did more because they actually did design advice. I think we saw them 6 times.
Yeah, Lloyd
Center
and also the
four times as
Collaborative Life Sciences came through quite a bit.
So is there a consideration of breaking by block now?
You know, blocks should have maybe been doing that. As an aside, the Lloyd Blocks group is currently underway on the four blocks to the south, so we need to fine-tune the process and things. And
you mean they're going to come back with another four-block development?
Yes.
Cool. Now, it sounds like for housing, there's a clear objective path that developers can take.
Not in the downtown, community design standards, right, only apply in like Hollywood. And
yeah, outside of Central City and Gateway.
Yeah.
So when we did our design review overlays, we were able to lock in discretionary design review for the Central City and for our Gateway because their regional centers were very well served by transit. And generally speaking, are very high density housing areas, and we weren't challenged as we are in other smaller, lower density areas by groups like Home Builders Association that didn't want us limiting or adding on additional fees or the perception of additional fees and costs of the design review process.
So, did you have to go through a legislative process at the state level to be able to do that?
Some of the handouts I gave you before, earlier at lunch, from 2007 when we did Senate bills 891 and 907, kind of speak to just that, where we were trying to apply more additional discretionary design for median and high density outside of Central City and Gateway. And that's why the testimony you had from the developer and from the architect in support of that was very valuable to us to bring forward to Salem and kind of say, you know, it's not that much more expensive. These are things you do anyway as a part of any natural design process. And if you put your ducks in a row and have that confidence, it's not a burden. And then in the end, it's a better project.
So in Central City and Gateway, you have to do design review?
Correct.
There isn't a clear objective box.
Historic districts, but that comes from more federal mandated.
Terwilliger and McAdam.
Yeah, you're right.
Is there
that's right, Carol. There's a couple others.
A long time ago. Yeah. A couple other super special areas.
Right. Yeah.
Now, when you say have to do design review, that doesn't necessarily mean coming to this commission.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
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 Right. Right.
But it is a discretionary process.
No.
Yeah. For us right now, for housing projects, we have to have a pretty effective path for all.
For all? Really?
We have no just areas that are excluded or special districts or anything. So one of the challenges we have is purely an opt-in process.
Mm-hmm.
How would you encourage that to be something?
worth their while. And when you have really only a different path to your own alternative, it's a different dynamic than you have here.
But there are things that, I mean, there are plenty of people that wish they could go down the clear and objective path to community design standards instead of coming through design review. And there's something about their site or there's something that they want to do with the building that they just can't check the thing off the list, so they have to go through design review.
It's hard because on one hand, we want to encourage the quality of design that's coming through. So we want to have some kind of an incentive that it makes it easier and better for people to go through a design review process. But we also have a community that I don't want to say, it's not, how do I put this? That saying no to a project, well, I'll just put it like this. The community we saw in this room,
right.
too,
yeah.
any change, you
right.
lose part of your view or your solar access,
right.
that's very difficult. That's legitimately hard based on your investment
right.
or
right.
where you're living. So the community is less happy to accept change,
mm-hmm.
and the design review moment gives them the opportunity to come forward and potentially stop a project or delay a project, which in some cases, given our thin margin, kills the project. So I don't know how that plays out here. For us, that's a really big issue, balancing
yeah.
those two.
Well, for it starts with planning, as you saw tonight, right? And so the idea that particularly at Gateway, there was a trade. There was a trade for design review for density. And that's the pact. And so if you say, we can give you additional FAR, we can give you additional height, and you come through design review for that additional kind of potential development, right? Right.
So do you think that's inherent that brings developers to the table outside the central city or areas where it's required?
I guess that, as you said earlier, major issues that just can't be circumvented on basic code standards. I think part of the carrot that brings people to the table is frankly the returns on the investment in your design and development. I mean, a lot of the neighborhoods that get a D overlay or desirable neighborhoods in some way. Right, right. We have some areas where
One of the limitations for using an objective standard track is a 55-foot height limit. But they may have height limits otherwise allowed taller than that, or floor area ratio is allowed taller than that, so they want to achieve that extra floor. And so if they want that green, they need to come through the discretionary path. And so that brings with it neighborhood investment. And so there's the carrot again, but that's kind of built into the standards. But as I was talking about before at lunch, those standards are things you can work on. These are standards you can sharpen, the tools you add to that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I noted with some of the projects, and we challenge, the reason why we want more discretionary review is the standards are a blunt tool. Some
mm-hmm.
people use it really well, some people don't.
So Glenn, I have a question for you. You mentioned the design standards and the desirable neighborhoods or areas. Do you think the neighborhoods are desirable because of the design standards, or that the design standards have made them desirable neighborhoods and such?
That's a really good question.
Which do you think came
first? That's a good question.
Yeah.
And it would be a hard one to answer. I mean, I think, I think about the Hollywood District as a, you know, people are wanting to build there, although it's a difficult neighborhood to develop for a number of reasons.
Yeah, but then you look at Vancouver Williams, right? I mean,
yeah.
I think that was just a neighborhood that was so close to town, its time finally came.
Exactly.
I mean, I just...
Look at, like, divisions. So there are...
Yeah,
like
divisions.
Like, it's just exploded.
Yeah.
There's no design review.
Yeah.
No.
And it's,
so,
like, one of the most vital places.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
right.
popping. So, and people want to live around there.
Right. Hawthorne District.
Yes,
you know,
it's almost like
no design
tracks, whereas the South
yeah.
Waterfront
oh, that is
completely
true.
Design
right.
Right. So it's almost like
okay.
the new neighborhoods, which
right.
are decided kind of by city,
that's
and then the other paths are private developers.
So
following the spirit of the city. So it's in something they don't meet, actually.
But what I will say is that I live in a neighborhood that doesn't enjoy design review. And there are a number of projects just popping up all over
mm-hmm.
the place. And I think we'd get better projects if there were a design review. And I get buttonholed a lot by people that don't understand that the whole city is under that, and or they think that every hot neighborhood should have it or whatever, so they'll say, how could you have let that thing get built in our neighborhood? And it's like, I don't, you know, no say.
I think there are so many other factors that make an area desirable besides the
I mean, yeah, I mean, it, we've just experienced these corridors of growth. I mean, Mississippi Avenue, Williams, Alberta. I mean, Hawthorne has been the inner part of Hawthorne now. Division, Belmont, the inner part of Belmont. I mean, what's happened is, and it makes sense, you know, the after the boom, there's this pent-up demand for housing, and developers are finding a perfect mix of really strong demand, low interest rates, and even in Portland, there are high development costs, but the rent price point is really high. And the closer you're in, the more desirable it is, because Portland's such a bike-centric, served by transit for the most part, except Division. So there, we find that to be a gap. You know, that we've had TriMet in here a couple times to kind of, what's going on with you guys? You know. But I think it's just, I don't think it really matters whether there's a design guideline in place or not. It's just about real estate and connectivity at this point, I think, and adjacency. You're right.
So, it's an interesting question. How do you measure the success of your program? Like, you mentioned earlier today that you, once a year, you kind of get a bully pulpit from council and are able to hold virtues of the program.
Well, the vibrancy of the city, I think, is one testament
Vibrancy of the city. How infrequently council has to hear from anyone except for us, you know. Yeah. How many people appeal projects?
Well, that's kind of basic. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the basic key metric, really. Right. Is, yeah. Right. Yeah.
I think it's, I don't know.
I'd say it's a really good question. Yeah. In fact, I've been asked, I think, post the city club, as we think about expanding design review in the city, and that's my personal concern is expanding it without either improving the two-track system, meaning the standards, the rules we have in place, beefing them up or making them stronger, or making it discretionary, period. You just get subjective humans involved. But the question, one way to look at it is, well, the commission hasn't denied anything. Now, but I task the commission every time, every retreat, saying, why not?
Yeah, we got to start. Then on that note, Tim, rather than, it's easier for me to measure the failures and the successes. Yeah. So when we drive around town, having been here almost 7 years, I see where we tripped. I see where we didn't deny something, and where, like David says, the bottom 20 feet of the project aren't successful. So you can kind of start to see and add on the conversations going forward. So it's only the places where we trip are easier to identify than where we succeeded.
Yeah, sadly. And they're so permanent.
Well, that's the thing. These are 50-year mistakes.
Yeah.
If you make a mistake, so it's kind of a heavy weight at times. You go, geez.
One fun way to measure success is to hear from the development team after they had a really difficult time here, and the air was heavy, and it was really tense and hard, and no one was liking each other. And a couple weeks later, it settled, and they were like, "Thank you." You know, they were come back and say, "Got better. Thank you. Thanks for, being tough." It's always there's a handful of projects.
So the designers feel like it serves the values of design.
Yeah.
Well, what we found too is often they use design commission as an editing tool for their clients.
Yeah.
Very, and I think you saw some of that tonight, for sure, and some of it where, okay, I'm not going to be able to convince my client, but design commission is going to set them straight, right? And then they go, woo, thank you, you know.
But I think that's something else, being all architectural background, civil engineering, and development background, we're all kind of aware of the cost of the decision. So when we say, over the years, we've talked a lot about, and as you guys mentioned, even probably more so important out of engineering, because the cost implications of design review would be significant if it's not measured well with the what you're asking the group to do. And I think that, as Kara says, a lot of these projects, people have realized, I think we're looking for savings too in the design or in editing the materials or in the, sometimes the just how the project works overall. So I think
in some cases, you've actually saved development teams hundreds of thousands of dollars on a project if it's done well. So if you can, I think if you can kind of also cultivate that feeling in a city, that it's not necessarily adversarial, it's really a group of people trying to improve a project in the city, that's probably the best.
We're not obstructionists. Some people think we are, but we're really not. Not at all. We are absolutely in favor of development. It just has to be of a certain type and quality. That's all it's about.
And there are teams, I think there are design, there are teams that we see often that have experience with the commission and are really talented people that will bring projects through, and it's a pleasure.
Yeah,
we'll
right.
see that maybe. They'll usually do it twice so that because they understand that the DAR, that this design advice request, which you saw tonight, is just a really great way to kind of get us kind of engaged and understanding what's going on. And then you'll just come back through one more time and show kind of where it went.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really, it can be enjoyable, actually. So, and then there are, it's amazing, there are other teams that just as soon as you see them, you just know, you're like, this is going to be in here 3 or 4 times mm-hmm. because it's just going to be really hard to live.
Yeah, when you get that envelope at work with the the stuff in it, like Karnak, you can just feel it sometimes. But when we do open it, it is oh no, or it's oh yeah. I mean, we can pretty much tell. There's a pattern.
I've often thought about somehow a city having an IDIQ list, like the federal government has an IDIQ list, which is where you qualify
right.
for your term. And you qualify 20 firms or something, mm-hmm. and you have to submit to qualify, you know? And if you have certain, you know, you fail or, you know, you get re-interviewed every 5 years, you know?
Sounds great.
Put the list back together. And I'll tell you, if you wanted to improve the efficiency of the process,
that would be
exponential.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It would be huge. Because it all has to do with the people that you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. But I think you're right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Where are you in the design or the design review of the public realm? Plazas, sidewalks, streets. I looked in the design guidelines and talked about corners and making better intersections.
Yeah, there's a lot of public. We weigh in on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
We have
presentations all the time from all the agencies that are doing things. Like the whole Greenway plan was part of a review.
The suspension bridge across the river,
we got to review.
Ben actually designed that.
Redesigned.
that was
he sketched it out right here.
Right. Yeah, so I'm not sure why we got to. Was it because it's a TriMet project that we got to review half the bridge?
Design overlay wasn't accepted.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was half the bridge.
Half the bridge was in a D zone, so we got to do half. And then.
So we assumed it would be symmetrical. We were just going on faith.
Unless there's a structure.
Some parks.
Are sidewalks included? I'm pushing on this a little bit because we're trying to do, we're trying to rethink our sidewalks downtown.
Yeah. Yeah.
How wide are they? How does the building meet them?
When street standards are established for an area, they'll come here for advice. Development wants to do something non-standard, that's absolutely designed to do. It's usually private now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But if a developer wants to do something in a public area, that's not standard. But South Waterfront Street Standards, you guys.
Well, and they did the East Side Industrial, they came through for that, right? And then recently the kind of taking up parking spaces for different uses for either, on the
street seats?
Street seats, yeah, that's it. Yeah.
You guys seen those? We've done little stuff too. We've done like where the vaults, like electrical vaults.
Oh, yeah.
Or at least we want to. And then...
Yeah, your power companies can... You ought to explain that a little bit, because it's a big deal, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, you guys get that. You know, that's all about, you have your own version of it. The power companies want to do it one way.
Yeah.
They want it to go in building.
How about the planters along the...
Oh, planter is my favorite. I don't think any
recycling
of you were
cans.
Here for that one, but...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We did recycling cans.
No, we did that one. That's right. But that was advisory, because it didn't...
Yeah. And we get a lot of briefings. Like, there's a lot of kind of just, you know, voluntary things that people put out there. Like, the Audubon Society had a bird-friendly design, you know, guidelines, and brought those in. And, you know, you see these things. I mean, that's it's, you see these things come up in the agenda, and you're like, huh, okay, we're going to talk about that.
But then the public toilets. The loos. The loos that are in our parks now, there weren't public toilets anywhere, so it's kind of a problem.
Where some of that's come from is now we're getting kind of the gray areas where part of the design commission's charter per code is to provide advice on design in the city, period, public, private. And so when the private is clearly defined, we have a land use process, standards process, whatever, when we get in the public arena, we've developed kind of incentive-based exemptions. So for instance, this Carol was talking about the standards. So we have a certain district that has a certain set of standards, what kind of benches, what kind of scoring in the concrete, what kind of lampposts, where the vaults go, stormwater, bike racks. We will have PBOT, Portland Bureau of Transportation, come kind of present that kit of parts. We'll review it, offer comments, you know, should it be stainless steel, should it be this color, should it be a wood bench, how should the concrete be scored, should it be brick, and then adopt those. And then we don't have to talk about it every time someone wants to do shoot. But when someone wants to change that standard and say, oh, I'd rather do bricks in the middle of my concrete right away and privatize my front entrance sequence, it requires another review. And our policy has generally been it's right away. It's public. It's not private. If you come in, we'll say no. So just do the standards.
So for standards like that, the standards are still adopted by council. Mm-hmm. But the recommendation.
Right. And that gets into the advocacy role. And so we'll push the chair and the commission leadership to get in City Hall often and kind of knock on doors, remind them what we do. We'll, as I said before, kind of the bully pulpit at the council once a year as part of our State of the City address. It's part of that, but it's also establishing a relationship. And then the retreats, the backup, is more internal with staff. And that's where we kind of review ourselves. That's our own report card on ourselves. We put a project up that we knew we shouldn't have said yes to, and then we review it, you know, just basically say, what did we learn from this? How do we keep moving the bar up? How do we inch it up? Not let it slide.
That's actually a good segue to a question. So if you, any of you are fresh or modify the program in some way, you know, better, what would you do? The salary could be.
true, absolutely, just a little.
I'm with you.
A little more food. Right.
Start with this group right here.
Well, I think the implementation of the DAR process was a step along those lines, right?
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah, if we could start over, what would we do?
What would we feel about the DAR being mandatory instead of discretionary?
Yeah. It's all, it's, even though it's not mandatory now, I don't remember the last project that came through without one.
I do.
Which one?
Riverscape. Those four.
Oh yeah. Well, that was a disaster.
It was a disaster.
So, yeah.
I think it should be mandatory.
And once it all goes up, we're all going to drive by it.
Yeah. So you could argue that if they had design advice, they would have come for less hearings. You know. So
right. Absolutely.
This is a lot, this is switchy, I'm going to say, and what I think would make it better is if the public were better informed about how this all works, how all of this is coming together. Some neighborhood associations in Portland work really well, some don't. I think they ebb and flow in terms of how representative they are, the people that live there, for better or for worse. I think it takes a lot of study to kind of push your arms around how all of them, you've seen codes look. Here I had it for a rush time, it's worse, right?
you can't know all that stuff inside and out as a single person. But I would like to come up with some way to build better relationships with the average citizens of your
We've often talked about part of, like, when you purchase a piece of property in Eugene, that part of the real estate kind of transaction, like their disclosures, that the city would provide a little 8.5 by 11 printout of all the surrounding properties and what the zoning is and what would be built on that.
Where have the real estate agents that provide that?
Wow.
If that were part of it, yeah. So everybody buying a piece of property was like,
I got
wait
it.
What's this mean? Right.
Yeah, what I wanted to say that I didn't say on that first one was, yeah, your realtor told you that nothing other than a 5-story building could be built there, but his realtor told him that he could build 175 feet, and guess what? His realtor was right.
Yeah. Right, that's right. That's right. It's yep.
Like, that's well, the thing about the neighborhoods being collectively educated, I mean, you have the planning chair of the Pearl District Neighborhood Association coming in here testifying in support of the project with a very well worded and very on the I just wanted to read this out loud to the audience, but yeah, and then you have everyone who lives in her neighborhood here opposing it because they didn't know any better when they bought their unit. And so I think that's just, for me, that's just.
If one person was involved in planning and tracking it and understanding it, and the other group is just like, what's happening?
And she's been doing it.
Well, the fact that for 13 years she's been in a role to craft the planning associated with all the things we're making decisions on here tonight or giving advice about in this case tonight, and they're opposing it because they don't know anything about any of that planning. They just live there. So what's up with that? That's the NIMBY thing, you know, it just... I have very little like empathy for it.
Really stage such a informal level of advisory capacity now, where normally once you get into the land use process, you've got notices going to everybody in the world and everything's formalized. Here, it's a little bit more, you know, by the seat of your pants in a way, and that informal nature can lead to those back to you're not notifying the world necessarily.
Well, obviously, that was a Tuesday night.
Right. You know, if that's a common thing you've
yeah.
seen.
Yeah,
it is.
It's such an informal level.
Right.
But the question comes, I even asked offline tonight, you know, is it our responsibility as an agency to educate the public or, you know, do this? I mean, we do outreach, right, and then we create resources that people can go to if they want to find information. But you can't bring the information to their table and serve it to them, spoon-feed it. You know,
we're facing exactly that same thing. We have
right.
two big buildings going up on very small sidewalks, and the public outcry is, how could we have let that? It's just a right-of-way, who owns what kind of thing. And, I mean, we were caught off guard. That's a hard, it's hard to predict what the issue will turn into.
Yeah, and we, you know, in the kind of early consultation that we do have, struggle with some of that at times too. We're trying to do outreach, we're trying to start early on. And yet we don't have all the information yet. We're the developers, you know, maybe partway through doing their design work as well. So it's not a complete picture. And there's this kind of expectation that all those questions can be answered right now. And so there's always that struggle. You try to get at these things early, you try to be transparent, but at the same time you can't possibly answer all those questions yet. And that's what the purpose of this kind of expectation sometimes of the public is it's
tough.
So I saw a little bit of that today. If you guys were facing
it,
it seemed pretty similar to
the policy's got a good point. I think the DAR should be the exact same notification as the it could cook pretty well in DAR.
That's like a year easier, man.
Yeah.
That was like Nary Cooper said, you guys already talked about and cooked it, and now you're just refining
yeah.
it.
Right.
So, I could see that.
Internally, when we decided to go to posting, which was probably 3 years ago,
yep.
we really thought we were doing the absolute right thing because the notification is only to, you know, a block and a half ring around the project. That's
yeah.
who gets it. So post the site, everybody gets it, right?
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
But this and this was the first time we got the negative feedback. It took me to specify that. Wow, I thought we were
going the right way.
Yeah.
It was all prompted just by Cassie.
Well, and they don't see it. They don't see it in the full context that you understand it. They're in this very narrow little purview of what's happening, you know.
That was too bad.
Well, part of the maybe in requiring it, I mean, for me, there's a couple things. One, they should do it anyway. I mean, we're even almost requiring type 2s in certain areas to come in for DARs. But by requiring one of those, puts it in the queue earlier. It potentially presets that kind of notice issue. But it also gives the DARs a little more hierarchy in the scheduling. You know, like today, we happen to have two DARs. If there wasn't a land use, if there was a land use, it would have gone first. And if we had three land uses, we would have bumped the DARs.
Yeah, the DARs.
But we gotta go by the clock. We got a 120-day clock. So if they're front-loaded, in the end, it adds time to the process. But it potentially adds a little bit more weight to why we want you to come in early for the DAR on a conceptual level. I thought the Methuen project came in. That's exactly the kind of detail we needed to have a good conversation. It still is a 3-month land use review process to do. Maybe 4.
I mean, I appreciate the tenor of these DARs being discretionary because, you know, you have an applicant or a potential applicant coming in, they're authentic with their interest in getting feedback versus a required process. You get disgruntled applicants coming in going, wow, shit, you're forcing me to come in for this advice. I don't, you know. I think there is some, I feel like the people coming in front of us for a DAR coming here because they really want to learn something, you know, and they're and that's what David was speaking to with regards to qualified versus not so qualified applicants and teams. Oh yeah, for sure. I think so. Yeah, I think the smart, very talented teams come in for DARs, and the ones who don't recognize that value don't.
I see something going on. I mean, I think that there are certain teams that are kind of avoiding development where they have to go to the design commission.
Yep. That's the strategy.
That's the strategy. Right. You stay in the neighborhoods. You try to stick to community design guidelines. Mm-hmm. You hope that the worst you get is a planner review. We have one team that got denied by the planner. They just couldn't get the project. So I mean, I think certain teams avoid type 3 again, and I think, and we've had a couple of guys that have come through here with design advice, and we talk to them, and you talk to them, and come back to another one, and then they wait a year, and they come back again, and you're like, oh my gosh, this thing again, you know. Just coming in for design advice doesn't necessarily mean that they're like, I've got it all lined up.
Right.
No, they're showing like good faith, even if they can't absorb the information.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, how do you project comes in for DAR is just absolutely horrible?
Just have to tell them to start over.
Well, there have been two that I know of that we said you just need to start over. And but not just arbitrarily start over. I mean, when we tell them to start over, we're telling them very specifically to what guidelines and why they're not meeting any of the guidelines at this point, or a significant number of them are lacking. And but we've also had the recalcitrant ones where they hear us and they just ignore us, and they come back, and then they still have that problem. I don't know an upcoming one if they...
One of the ones that
might be coming in next week, we don't know.
We got called on this forum last week was, you know, people that sort of go, okay, if we've got 9 issues with our project, we're going to pick off like 2 at a time every time they come back.
Right, right.
We're just going to kind of wear them down. But the big one they're asking us to make, they're going to move on. So I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to throw a sculpture here, I'm going to take one material off, and, you know, so there's this process, you know, what people call wearing us down. You know.
So they'll get 8
to
9, hoping that she'll
stick
in the 9th,
and
that's the deal breaker.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And then, sound like you do. And their mentality of a checklist is always wrong, because you guys say it all the time, it's the spirit of the comments. It's not, okay, do this, you're good.
Right.
And our of people who just have to have this checklist in place. It's not, you saw it today.
Yeah, I thought that was actually pretty interesting because I was kind of expecting the, okay, do this, this, and this, and then come back or not. And it really wasn't that way. It was just kind of this.
I think it gets more that way.
It gets more specific with the more information that we have, right. But we're not, the big thing, with the exception of Ben, is we don't design the project for them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just only half, the Ben Bridge.
You're good looking.
I think that goes back to staff is what you see in this room kind of represents hours of meetings behind the scenes of this relationship that staff has with the commission in these hearing settings translates in my mind right now about 10 different projects that are on 10 different plan of staff. So in different ways, different skills. So a lot of what we're doing is kind of taking back what we hear here with integrity, kind of squishing 7 commissioners' comments into one mouth and getting that information forward, trying to balance that. And sometimes they're aligned and sometimes they're not. But also what the integrity is saying, I told you so, but you know, it's your decision to bring what you want to the table.
So there's a lot of trust.
I mean, what we'd like to be able to do a lot of times is here are the issues, go work it out with staff, but you're approved, but we can't do that. We can do it to some degree, but if we have modifications, they have to be very specific on what we want them to do. That's why it's so hard to craft a modification, because you're basically, you are just doing what I said we didn't do. You're telling them how to design a particular aspect of something because it's a particular sticking point with us, but.
Yeah, if you make the brick yellow, pass.
Right, or add 25% more glass or whatever it is, but you know, and do it this way, and that's where it gets really, I think you go down a slippery slope. For me, it feels very.
Following up on your comment, I think potentially it goes into the staff level and how it can be seen, but it also goes out from 7 commissioners out into the city itself, through our firms and through our practices and through our opinions. It's really interesting. In my years, I've learned more than I think I've even done anybody.
Yeah,
by a long shot, I've taken that out into my professional skill. I think that's the kind of exciting part about this, the rock and the pond around the design review, because it really does ripple beyond. That's what when I was tasked to join it, I didn't even know what it was. But I was in architecture, but since then, of course, that's worked a great, great deal. I think I've taken that back out. That is the growing influence of design review, both internally and externally.
So I think
the same thing happens. Yeah, the same thing happens out of each conversation we have.
I think to that end, to the kind of personal aspect of it, I think if there were things to, if you're crafting your own program, I would put a big circle around the kind of people that you choose for these roles. And there are a few that I want to comment on, like aspects of the character I think that are important. I think on the staff side, I think one of the things that you really need on the staff side that we have a lot of is a representation of the kind of guidelines, but also an overarching eye towards kind of common sense, which I think, like when you have a set of guidelines, if you just take those things, you can drive it down any rabbit hole, you want. And I think at a certain point, I think Kara in particular, the city is a good example of someone that has a kind of really good understanding of like when the guidelines all taken all together, like what actually really makes sense in a given application. I think that just comes from experience and years of doing something. But I think that's a really important thing if you want the public and the development community and everything to appreciate what you're doing and not get this all bent out of shape. It's having people on that staff side that really have that eye towards, okay, I'm implementing this thing, but you get the kind of big picture. And then I also think that, and I think our commission right now really has it, is I think there's just a general level of respect for the people on the other side of the table. And I think that's really important to keep the kind of city community at large feeling like, because in the reality is, and I think we'd all admit that, I mean, we're all up here, and we have experience now doing this for years. Some of the time, I'm one of the younger ones, but these guys have a lot of experience doing this, and I just think that there's also a kind of palpable kind of we're all on the same team, we're all trying to get to this thing together that is kind of egoless and it's just positive.
Yeah.
And I think that's really hard to, you gotta find that. And not think, and I'll just say one of the reasons I got involved in this is because I've been not at this commission but in other ones, like in other jurisdictions and that, where you're sitting across from people that really have just no business being up there. You know, and it just, I mean, there are people just right off the sidewalk. Not kidding, like that's actually a position.
Probably
like,
from
it's
Eugene.
Like percent large,
you know? Right. You get a hot meal. You get a hot meal with that design commission.
Yeah. I think some level of professional experience. I think we're at a point now where the commission often gets. It's kind of through recommendation, like the people that are outgoing recommend. I mean, I know that's how I arrived on the commission.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good way. I mean, that's, you can't institute that, but I think it is a good way because people that sit here understand what that takes, and then they are really smart about people that can fill that.
It's extremely humbling. It's one of those things where you realize that something that falls out of your mouth might have just cost somebody $100,000, and you really think about what you say. You do have the power to deny people's projects, and you do have the power to limit someone's view, and you do, there's all this stuff that's there, and you have to be really responsible to the process of one another, and everyone in the room, not just the people on the other side of the table, but I think we have a responsibility to hear people out, as wrong as we think they might be about their perspective or developing the neighborhood.
It's the seniority of this, or it's not seniority, it's the authority of this group that presupposes a kind of higher level of thinking about everything. And the reality is we're just all judging our peers. I mean, we're at no other level than what Kurt Schultz was, we're all in the same kind of strata. There are other commissions around the world that will sort of solicit the kind of Uber, whoever, from across the country to come sit on something, or they try and institute that authority. I don't think that's really a great thing to do, necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's better to just understand that authority is not a kind of ego anymore. It's a kind of responsibility.
It's true, I think we talked a lot about it. I don't think any of us want Portland to become Carmel, California. And I don't think just kind of exercising one way of thinking, that's not where we want Portland, I'm sure that's not where you guys want. And so speaking a lot of times with this group, we're always kind of struggling. Personal taste is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want the whole city to end up looking the same. So how do you balance, what are the important issues to really talk about? It's not necessarily, aesthetic, of course, but it's not necessarily that. It's activity at the street level and how really citizens can enjoy the building as opposed to our particular interests about what a building's facade looks like. And I think the more uniform that this body becomes, the more you end up in Carmel, California.
One of the aspects of that, of what you're talking about, when these conflicting elements hit permanency of materials and my budget, right? I can't afford brick on this whole thing. Well, so, but there's a qualitative aspect to that, like we just talked about, you're building a 50-year-old building. Is it going to be dilapidated in 20 years? And become a slum or something other than what it should be. So that sometimes is a very tricky aspect. I mean, we didn't even really accept vinyl windows until recently. And there's still, I think they've come a long way from what they used to be. So, but we still don't know what the longevity of, industrial grade vinyl window is.
Black coated.
Yeah, right.
Cladding made of rice husks.
Huh?
Cladding made of rice husks.
Yeah, right. We had all kinds of materials that.
I can't tell you whether that's permanent.
Right.
I know
right.
telling us there's a warranty on it. But, we even looked at a material that was warrantied. It said right there on the cut sheet they handed to us, there's no warranty for this weathering steel as a roof product.
Right.
And so you see, the
could put it right in front of us, and we're like, well, this isn't, yeah, no, this isn't going to work.
How do you keep up with that? You put the kind of burden of proof on the applicant to show us that this is a product?
Sometimes we do. I know some of us depend on... I depend on architects. I depend on David and Ben.
Right, I depend.
Oh, I'm an architect too. So I think there's a we depend on each other's expertise to let us know, is this a good idea? Is this detail going to work? Is it flashed right? Is it, you know, is the, this edge going to come apart or whatever? And I think the most recent one was Kurt's project where they were trying to get Artie board hand installed five floors up for like 20 foot long lengths. And I was like, I don't think that's a good idea. It just doesn't seem so. They came back and they changed it to a metal panel that had a preformed corner. So sometimes, you know, it has an immediate impact. Other times, you know, it's sometimes there's just a leap of faith that our peers, as David said, are going to come through.
And sometimes something gets built, and you're like, next time I'll pay attention to that.
Right.
You know,
right.
If you think you have B-side 6 right. And the age of the metal leads on the back of the corner.
Right. Yeah.
It's a really cool building. Real departure and great piece of architecture from Portland. And the backside of it looks like it needs to be
iron. So, do you go after something after it's built, after it's weathered
a
little? You go? Do you go to take a tour of your work, essentially?
Not as a group, we haven't,
yeah,
but
like
individually,
to,
we all.
That's actually something.
Individually, we do.
Yeah.
Right.
Not as much as we'd like. We'd like to do a lot more, and we do it on our own. But
this will be something that we'll do with staff for professional development, but also bring that back to the commission. But also the commission is out, and I would say material longevity and permanence, especially new materials, is definitely one of the biggest challenges.
Yeah.
We have approved projects that look beautiful in rendering, look beautiful on a material board that's required, but 10 years later we see them delaminate.
Right.
But that's somewhat the nature of the field,
right.
Testing these new materials in our Pacific Northwest climate.
And you have to be a resident of Portland too.
No, technically you don't, because it's not that specific.
I think mostly, though, I live in living. But kind of combining our visit with you guys would be invaluable.
Yeah.
I love that idea. Yeah, I want to do more of that. More of that. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that you tend to have the perspective of looking at the common good for the whole community, not just maybe one specific neighborhood or one specific area, how it affects Portland as a whole. And I think that's important because you have specific neighborhood identities, yes, but you still have to look at the Portland.
Yeah.
I appreciate that, but I do want to say, I mean, that is a topic of discussion. I mean, I often think we're looking at a block or two. I mean, we're looking at, we don't do a whole lot of, I mean, that was one of the, Tim sent that email out recently. I got my ear bent by this architect in town, which made me think, I don't know, you know, right or wrong, it's a good debate. It's like, you know, we aren't a, we're not a city that has a kind of holistic kind of, there's nothing holding our city together as a design, as a thing. I mean, there's no that kind of continuity as making the city as a whole. I think we have a transit plan, we have, things like this, but architecturally we don't.
No.
Yeah, architectural, expression-wise, style-wise, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Like something like that. I mean, we have the way that we have our guidelines, but those guidelines...
Well,
really
it's a very, very American in that way. I mean, we're a Western American.
City, but
with this sort of
weird
desire
to be
something
else.
I've been thinking about a lot, which is why I've been mentioning sort of what's the city as a whole. And I think we think of it as, how it links it to its neighbors and things like that.
It's really a series of villages tied together. I mean, really, Portland is a bunch of little towns mashed together in one city, and it's literally true.
Every neighborhood has its little retail center.
Yeah.
That was early 20th century, basically. Right. And but the interesting thing about that, they were all born out of the streetcar. We had an incredible streetcar network that went up every one of these avenues that are now experiencing growth in the last couple of years. And that's why they're there, because they were so connected.
It was anyway. Built in there what's that? Yeah, they're still there.
Right. Yeah. Right. 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 Right.
One part of, I just want to say, you mentioned, economics kind of right now and how design review relates to that. And just to kind of something that I've just experienced in the short time I've been in here is that I think the quantity of building and the size of buildings and even that, especially since I moved here, and I'd say it happens really fast. And if you're seeing a 120-foot tall building right now, in the next 5 years, you could be reviewing like a dozen a year. I mean, you don't know. I mean, it's really...
The economics in Eugene have dramatically changed.
Yeah, right. Well, and it sounds like, it's really
that's
good
true.
Thing.
That's true. It's a lot of those are student housing.
Mm-hmm.
The two biggest ones, a $90 million project and a $45 million project on student housing.
Yeah.
I think we've seen enough. I don't think our council will.
Yeah.
But really, the economics in Eugene over the last 4 years are really dramatically different.
It's great. And I guess I just wanted to commend you for thinking about this at this moment, because if the city hasn't yet experienced that kind of explosion, having something in place before that starts to happen, it's really great that you're thinking about that.
I feel a sense of urgency.
Yeah. That's not misplaced. I would agree with that.
And on that note, just one other thing I want to say is that I've thought a lot about, and we're facing it now, where the city, the core of Portland is becoming so expensive that people who have kind of blue-collar jobs are having to move farther from the core. So I think one thing we all in Portland have to be aware of, I don't think this is necessarily in the immediate future, but like David said, it's not soon to come, is not make everything so precious that it becomes unaffordable. I think often in cities that have, Haley, Idaho, or Sun Valley, that you can't even so you're shipping in all the people who are at the restaurant. So I always think about the hat, and I don't know, when we talked about it here, how you have veins of affordability that come into a core, kind of like Rio de Janeiro, for instance, but that's not the plan. But if you have these veins of unimproved areas somehow, veins of part of affordable housing, or rent control, or just untouched properties that aren't, that may be not overseen by a body that is always making it better and better looking and better. Because I think that's one thing to lose is to see it's happening here pretty far before.
It'd be the first stuff developed, probably.
We kind of led over the last few years. We didn't have the opportunity to do market development, so we sort of led with affordable housing or workforce housing. But in the since this new wave came through, none of those were really affordable projects, except one, West 10 on 8. We're now looking at the redevelopment of our riverfront, and some of the discussion has included affordable housing, but I'm going to look at it. I'm going to think about what you just said. I like that idea of veins of affordability so that all the way through you have workforce housing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think our guidelines try to dodge the talk about its quality and determinants. It's not just expensive. And I think that's important. That we've got our guidelines written in such a way that they don't, it doesn't necessitate expensive building.
No.
I think the message that would be just really great to get out is like the less money you have to spend on the building, the more you need to spend on people thinking about that building.
Right. Exactly.
The amount of thought you have to put into trying to make really inexpensive materials work is the opposite. I mean, typically teams, it's, I have very little budget, so I'm going to spend my design team very little time to think about what we're going to do with this really cheap stuff. And it's got to, they don't go together. So.
And use eight cheap materials and figure out technology.
Right. Anyway, so that's a message that we're trying to
get out. Yeah, right.
Less money you have, the smarter you have to be, and more time you can figure it out.
Yep.
Right.
See you.
Thank you. Good luck.
Thanks.
And then Paige can tell you all about what kind of electronic setup you
have. Oh, yeah. It won't be this.
We're redoing our whole setup.
Thank you all so much for
this. This was really good.
Yeah.
It's your insights were good.
Was that helpful?
Extremely.
You guys done?
You guys are.
You had enough?
It'd be great.
Your brain's full.
This kind of relationship, I think, is really important. Mm-hmm. For us, we were just
the one last thought, too, is these are 150 sheets sometimes.
Oh, yes.
So you guys can beat us. You can beat the city of Florida by starting an iPad.
Right.
Just have it all downloadable. And my boy can have it.
Yeah. When are we getting our iPads? When what? When's the room?
I think the GBD packet would have paid for iPads for all of us and the audience.
They had literally three-ring binders, 11
by 17s that were this thick.
The last one was about
color
that
glossy.
Yeah.
We meet with the consultant tomorrow.
Go and eat one of those as a night.
We're good.
Great. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.